with each other. It's been a very stimulating day for me so far, and unfortunately for me, I'm the last speaker, since I know what I'm going to say, it won't be that stimulating for me. I was thinking about Laura's beautiful images, and I'm afraid at the end of this day, what I'm going to throw at you, like a good lawyer, is a lot of words. So my PowerPoint is meant as a vehicle for textual analysis. I wish it could be otherwise, but I hope that what we'll be able to do in the next little while is to dwell a little bit on one particular aspect of the life of privacy in the United States that we've touched on, but we haven't really developed a conversation about yet, which is the constitutional right to privacy. It is separable and separate from the kinds of questions we were asking about cybersecurity and surveillance this morning. It partakes in its own way of the kinds of concerns that Laura was describing when she talked about what it would be like to live in a world where there was full transparency and the kinds of thrills and dangers that are associated with a lack of privacy. I also want to sort of highlight something that Austin Sarrett said yesterday, which is the potentiality, at least, if not the actuality, for understanding privacy as a kind of incoherent category, a catch-all category, something that covers maybe too many things, and so can't in the end help us as an analytic tool at all. And I want to make a tentative argument based on some thinking, I would say preliminary thinking I'm doing about the right to privacy and current constitutional litigation, particularly, of course, we're talking in the present moment about gay rights litigation, that there are certain ways to try to think about putting some content into the right to privacy, that they're contingent. They're contingent ways to do it. And I'll be interested to hear what you think or have to say about the argument when I'm done, because I wouldn't say it's a fully fleshed out argument yet. The references to Fourier and free love, free sex, hooking up are a perfect way, perfect entry into my talk, because one of the things insofar as I know, the history of these kinds of free love movements happened was, of course, a recoiling in disgust at the possibility of this kind of sexual culture, this idea that everybody would be sleeping with everybody else and it didn't matter what you did, and that you should follow your passions, right? And one of the things that one can say about the right to privacy, and privacy, I would say privacy generally, is not only that it is in some ways valuable in the ways we've been describing, but also very dangerous. That privacy is dangerous. It's not just enabling, or it enables things that are dangerous. And as a corollary, then, we might say that the right to privacy is dangerous as well, if it exists at all. And of course, there are many people still in this country who would argue as a constitutional matter that the right to privacy is a kind of ruse, that it is conjured out of thin air, that it has no basis in constitutional text, that it's illegitimate, and it's unbounded, and therefore frightening, and that we simply ought to get rid of it. I think there are still members of the current Supreme Court who believe that. And it's worth taking up that question. The question of the danger of the right to privacy is really a question of where it ends. Where does the right to privacy end? How do we understand when it stops? We talked yesterday a little bit about the ways in which you can't do anything you want in your house. I mean, you can't murder somebody in your house, right? And just say, well, I am protected by my right to privacy. That there is some commonsensical harm principles that undergird our sense that there is a limit to privacy. But can we say more about that? And in particular, how is the right to privacy and this concern about the boundary of it playing out in contemporary constitutional litigation? And the argument I want to begin to forward in a tentative way to you today is that in the last, well, really starting with Roe versus Wade implicitly, and in the last 10 years in gay rights litigation in particular, what's happened on the court is that there's been a conflation of privacy and equality arguments. And that equality arguments, and particularly for those of you who are lawyers, and you might know what I'm saying, and for those of you who aren't, thank God, but I'll try to explain it later, particularly the idea of formal equality, that everybody who's alike should be treated the same way, can operate as a kind of break on the slippery slope concerns about where the right to privacy might go. But that in and of itself has its own cost. So that's the overall argument I want to try to make to you today. Privacy is dangerous. The right to privacy is dangerous. Insofar as it's dangerous, we need to figure out, A, whether it exists at all, and B, where it should end. And then we have a debate about what that all means. All right. I'm going to give you a rendering of the jurisprudence of privacy that is partial. So those of you who are lawyers will notice that this is a partial rendering. It's designed to fit into a 45-minute format and accomplish, as a good lawyer would want to do, my argument. So I've left some things out. But the first thing that I want to say is that we're at a moment where there is this great debate about precisely what privacy means as a constitutional matter. And if you look at this debate from the 2003 case Lawrence versus Texas, you'll see it playing out in the very language. So Lawrence versus Texas was a case that came down overturning Texas's ban on sodomy, on same-sex consensual sexual relations. It overturned a prior case, Bowers versus Hardwick, about which I'll speak very briefly a little bit later. It was a landmark in gay rights litigation, and it was a right to privacy case. The underlying facts are variously told, but the bottom line in this case is that there were two men in an apartment with a closed door, having sex in a bedroom, and a police officer came to the apartment, a roommate who didn't quite know what was going on in the bedroom, opened the door, let the police officer come in with a warrant. The police officer found these two gentlemen in a bedroom having sexual relations and arrested them. Very unusual case, but certainly goes to the heart of the right to privacy as it's imagined by the Fourth Amendment at any rate. Justice Kennedy, in the majority, liberty protects the person from unwarranted government intrusions into a dwelling or other private place, but, you might say, freedom extends beyond spatial bounds. Liberty presumes an autonomy of self that includes freedom of thought, belief, expression, and certain, notice the certain, intimate conduct, right? Not all intimate conduct. So what Justice Kennedy is expressing here and what he just expressed in a case I'll talk about at the end, United States versus Windsor, this past summer's Defense of Marriage Act case, is an expression of privacy that he links specifically with an understanding of liberty. Liberty found in the Due Process Clause, and we'll talk about that in a minute. And that is quite expansive, right? And thinks about individuals, persons, and their relations to the state. Justice Scalia, in dissent, takes a different tack in understanding the problem here. The Texas statute undeniably seeks to further the belief of its citizens that certain forms of sexual behavior are immoral and unacceptable. The same interest furthered by criminal laws against fornication, bigamy, adultery, adult incest, bestiality, and obscenity. This decision effectively decrees the end of all morals legislation. All right? Now, I think Justice Scalia is correct in some respect, but what we have here is what we call in law school a slippery slope argument. That is to say, you start at a certain point in the hill, and because you got the ball rolling, it's going to roll all the way to the bottom of the hill until we get to bestiality. And ugh, who would ever think that the criminal law shouldn't prohibit bestiality, ergo, right? That's a slippery slope argument. The main point Justice Scalia is making, though, is that there has been a long history in the United States dating back to basically the mid-19th century, but certainly in certain moral communities much farther back, that merged criminal law with a sort of moral code. Morals legislation really took off in the mid-19th century in the United States under a certain kind of Protestant ethos. Laws against sodomy, fornication, and the like, many of them were passed in the mid-19th century, and he thinks that that's an appropriate relation between law and morality, whereas Justice Kennedy wants to leave morality, or at least most morality, to individual decision-making. So that's the tension we inhabit here when we think about privacy as dangerous, right? I think everybody in this room would say, you know, there's something that you ought not to be able to do in private, right, that we would criminalize. And if that's true, then the key question is not should we, but how should we, right? All right. Now, the right to privacy was first articulated in Griswold versus Connecticut in 1965. Austin Sarrett alluded to this and read a little bit of it yesterday. This was a case in which Connecticut had long ago, again, late 19th century, passed some statutes prohibiting the distribution, sale and distribution of contraceptives to married and unmarried couples. And it was challenged in the early 60s. And the court overturned that statute, said you cannot prohibit the distribution of sale of contraceptives to married couples. So the issue in Griswold was marriage. Okay? And what the court said, and this is what everybody makes fun of, and I'm going to try to get us to a point where we don't make fun of it today, that the right, there is a right to privacy. It's not written in the Constitution, but it emerges from the penumbras formed by emanations from the first, third, fourth, fifth, ninth, and 14th Amendments. Now, what's a penumbra? Anybody know Latin? You remember your Latin? Excellent. We all know what emanation is, right? So shadows thrown by the light from these amendments, okay? And note the rhetoric here. This is very important to the court's decision. We deal with a right of privacy older than the Bill of Rights, right? Something that predates the writing of the Constitution, older than our political parties, our school system, marriage, and note the emphasis on marriage because I'm going to come back to this in the end, is a coming together for better or worse, hopefully enduring. That's Douglass's four weddings. He really liked those. And intimate to the point of being sacred, a degree of being sacred. And then the language, for way of life, harmony, loyalty, noble, right? So this is high-stakes rhetoric here. And you can imagine, you know, in 1965, maybe you felt the same way. Like, the police are going to go into my bedroom and grab my contraception? That doesn't feel very good to me, right? This is the 60s, right? So we have a decision that, at least from our vantage point, and maybe from a commonsensical vantage point in the 1960s, feels right. Feels right. Why should the state tell married couples whether or not they can use contraception? It's sort of a bizarre premise. This is the case that gave birth to the right of privacy. What I'd like to do is a little exercise where we look at the first, fourth, fifth, third, fourth, fifth, and ninth. Well, maybe I think we'll skip the ninth and 14th. And you tell me where you see privacy in them, okay? So let's go to the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. The word privacy is not in there. Where is it? Uh-huh.
Well, I just want to say that this doesn't tell us really what our rights are. It says what the government can't do.
Perfect. Very nice observation. What you've gotten to is the most important thing to understand about the Bill of Rights, which is that all 10 amendments were written as a limit on state power. That was federal power, yes, federal power. And then incorporated in the 14th later on. Federal power, state meaning political theory, state, not state. So a limit on state power, which means, right, that the fundamental concern of the founders was limiting state authority over them. This is very important. As a sort of initial premise, the idea is limiting government through the whole of the Bill of Rights. Yeah.
Stanley was grounded on the First Amendment, mm-hmm. or said it was.
Yep. Yeah.
But there it is.
Yep.
There's the right to look at pornography in your own home. Somewhere in there.
Where is it?
Well, you know, I can see it. Can't see it.
No. Tell me where it is. Jack. Yes.
I spent a lot of years on the board of directors of my local Planned Parenthood.
Yes.
And the Action Fund. We love Griswold.
Yeah.
As we go through this exercise, which I think I'm seeing you doing, let's not only ask the question about how these amendments apply to married people or single people, let's ask how they apply to corporations. Where do we find that the First Amendment anything applies to hobby?
Well, yeah.
Everybody's playing the same game.
Well, it's an interesting question. If we could bracket the Hobby Lobby just for a moment, right? Because I don't want to talk about free speech rights. What I want to try to get at is this question. How, you know, is there a way to think along with Douglass about what might have been assumptions assumptions that are built into the architecture of the Bill of Rights. I mean, we can disagree, but I'd like to think along with him for a minute and see whether there's any credibility to this argument. I tend to think, actually, there is, and I'm going to read you a little bit of John Locke in a little bit in order to try to bolster my argument. But you might not be convinced, and that's fair. Servette, did you want to jump in? Okay, good.
Traditionally, as I understand it, I mean, religion has been treated in the private domain.
Okay.
As an act in the private domain, and prohibiting the free exercise thereof prevents Congress from passing laws to interfere in the private domain.
Of belief? Of private domain of thought, belief, conscience? Okay, yep. Okay, good. So we've got something about belief and conscience that's at the heart of the Free Exercise Clause. I think that that's a fair interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause. Abridging freedom of speech or association? Does that have anything to do with privacy?
Association.
How so?
If the government is telling you with whom you may not associate, that's...
Okay. All right, good. That's right. Yes? So we have some, and we have some evidence that what's implicit in these words has something to do with my choice with whom I associate, my ideas about what I can believe, and maybe, although this is obviously implicating the public as more than the private, what I can say, what I believe, what I can say. All right, let's go to the Third Amendment. This is a little obvious. Austin couldn't remember the Third Amendment. I don't know why. No soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner prescribed by law. Yes?
Well, the implication of that, and that's, I think if Douglas had used the words implication rather than...
Penumbra and emanations? You don't like the poetry of that?
Well, it's nice poetry.
It is, isn't it?
I mean, judges and lawyers are used to talking about the implication of certain things.
Yeah.
And the implication of that is the kind of my home is my castle.
Good. All right, so this is what we might assimilate to the idea of geography, something Austin brought up yesterday, or space. You have a house, and nobody can force you to take in soldiers without your consent. And consent is the other part of this. It's not just the house. It's that you let people in. You make a decision about whether to keep your place private or not. So this one seems kind of a little... easier for me. Fourth Amendment, the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. This is most classically associated with privacy rights, right, in a kind of a sturdy sense. What does it protect?
Hmm?
Stuff? My stuff. Excellent. Not just stuff and houses. People. My body. Right? You can't take my body and do what you want with it. I am secure in my body, as well as my house and my papers and my effects are secure against, notice, unreasonable searches and seizures. It's important, right? There's a balancing act involved here, and this goes to the question this morning, like, you know, what do we think about having an orderly world? Again, that's where the danger of privacy gets marked in the Constitution. Unreasonable searches and seizures. If it's reasonable, if you're doing something nasty, then you don't have a right to privacy. That's the balancing part there. Good. Okay. Yes.
Yep. Allows the government to say there's something going on, we have to trust.
That's right. That's right. And implicit in the police powers of municipalities and states and the federal government is the idea that, you know, states can keep order, can keep good order. So you always have to balance that possibility with, again, what's really important about the Bill of Rights, which is a limit on government power. Yeah.
I assume that probable is a term of art that has which may be 70-80%. It's not like 51%.
Right. Probable cause is a higher standard.
What is that?
Well, it's more than more likely than not. It's having some evidence. Yes.
It's less than 5149.
It's less than 5149? Is it really?
Yes.
Well, he's a judge, so I would listen to him. Less than 5149?
It's less than more probable than not.
So it's less likely than not.
Considerably less than more likely.
Yeah, okay. I would listen to him. And, you know, there are different cases, too, that suggest in different places the standard can be lower. There are stop and frisk cases and the like that don't require probable cause. You know, if there's something happening immediately, you don't have to run and get a warrant. Right. All right. And the Fifth Amendment, no person shall be held to answer for capital otherwise than for his crime unless upon presentment or indictment of a grand jury, except in cases arising in the land or naval forces or in the militia, blah, blah, blah. Nor shall any person be subject for the same offense to be twice put in jeopardy of life or limb, nor shall be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation.
Liberty.
Good. Say more about it.
I think it's all liberty.
Hmm?
I think it's all liberty.
Okay.
Privacy has been a diversion. I'm not saying it's not as usable, but it has distracted and bedeviled the discussion from Griswold on, and especially from Roe on.
Yep.
Because Roe was about, I say, liberty.
Yep.
Because the things you can't do to some people and not and others.
Yep.
And so that's why Austin's right about privacy.
Now I'm going to have to disagree on principle because we co-teach and I always have to do that.
Instead of trying to take privacy and apply it,
right.
Look at the case and see what the violation is.
Yep. Yep. Well, I think liberty, you're anticipating my argument, actually, because in the end what happens is that Justice Kennedy turns to a language of liberty in order to fuse privacy and equality.
Right there, right?
Yeah?
You have in his quote from Lawrence.
Right?
But
he uses that word.
But he didn't talk about privacy, he talked about liberty.
Right, I know. Well, that's the move.
Persuaded.
No, I persuaded you. You just didn't know yet because you haven't gotten to the end of my talk. You're channeling my, yes.
All your words and actions are recorded endlessly. How would you not be incriminating yourself over a long period?
Well, I mean, you're also anticipating a problem, right? Which is the problem of misunderstanding. You know what creating speech as data. That's what's happened, I think, with this online stuff. Things that we used to think of as our own speech, First Amendment speech, I get to say what I want, I get to put out there what I want or not, have now become data because they're iterable, right? Recordable and iterable.
Then how would they not be documents or papers?
Well, you've got at the heart of a problem, haven't you? In a world in which everything that we conjure as ourself is turned into an avatar and then endlessly reproduced, we don't have a bounded self that we can say can't incriminate us. I think you've got exactly the problem. We'll skip the 9th and the 14th for now, although it's worth noting for those of you who are not lawyers and don't sit around and read the Constitution every day that the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment is in the 14th Amendment, but also this idea of the Equal Protection Clause, that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And that is also a term of art, very hard to understand. We'll get to that in a little while. All right. Now, how can we understand Griswold's claim that the right to privacy is older than the Bill of Rights? I've just tried to at least show you the possible ways in which some parts of the Bill of Rights implicitly, shall we say, suggests that there is something we might call a right to privacy, you might call it liberty, it might be a better way to do it, but that Griswold decided to call it the right to privacy. Griswold also claimed that it was older than the Bill of Rights. I don't have time to make this argument out to you in full, but let me just take you to John Locke, who was a foundational 18th century political theorist, very heavily read by those founders who wrote the Constitution. John Locke had a theory that Alistair MacIntyre, in a very famous book written about 30 years ago, called a theory of possessive individualism. The idea is that we can understand human nature by understanding ourselves as self-owners. We own ourselves. We own ourselves. John Locke says, though the earth and all inferior creatures be common to all men, yet every man has a property in his own person. This nobody has any right to but himself. The labor of his body and the work of his hands, we may say, are properly his. All right? So the claim here, and really I think I want you to understand it actually in historical context, which is to say in a world where there are slaves, is a claim that free men, and I'll gender that in a minute more clearly, own themselves. We own ourselves, and we own the fruits of our labor, our property. And what does that mean? It means that the natural liberty of man is to be free from any superior power on earth, and not to be under the will or legislative authority of man, but to have only the law of nature for his rule. Now, when you escape the state of nature through the social contract, freedom of men under government is to have a standing rule to live by, common to every one of that society, and made by the legislative power erected in it, a liberty to follow my own will in all things where that rule prescribes not, not to be subject to the inconstant, uncertain, unknown, arbitrary will of another man. All right? So this is a theory of limited government that justifies itself on the basis of a theory of property. You know, it's the home is your castle, the body is your castle, the self is your castle. As long as the government doesn't do things that are arbitrary, I may live in a world that it can regulate my conduct. But if some arbitrary, inconstant, uncertain, and unknown will of somebody else is exercised on me, I have a right to resist that on the theory that I own myself, that I am an owner of my own self. This is very powerful language. Locke says he took it out of the Declaration of the Rights of Man, but they sure left it in the Constitution. So, right, due process protects life, liberty, and property. So property theory and this theory of human nature are really part of what subtends, I would argue, the Bill of Rights itself. And if you think about privacy together with property, and this is something that Dan suggested a little bit earlier, you have an old, we might say old-fashioned or even outdated understanding of what privacy might look like, right? The capacity to introduce boundaries to resist the arbitrary incursion of somebody else's will on yourself and your effects and your labor. Now, this idea of a human self had a social landscape, and I want to suggest to you that this is an important thing because when we return to the idea of equality arguments later on, I'll try to make an argument that it matters, right? So John Locke is saying the natural liberty of man, and he uses the word man as men did back then. But in addition to writing in a world in which there were enslaved peoples who were themselves property, John Locke also wrote under a common law regime in England that included this legal doctrine called coverture. I don't know if any of you have ever heard of this doctrine. The idea, and this is William Blackstone in his famous commentaries on the laws of England, by marriage, the husband and wife are one person in law. That is, the very being or legal exercise of the woman is suspended during the marriage, or at least is incorporated and consolidated into that of the husband, under whose wing, protection, and cover she performs everything, and is therefore called in our law French, a femme couverte, that is said to be a couverte baron, or under the protection and influence of her husband, her baron or lord, and her condition during her marriage is called her coverture. So like she's under a blanket. When woman and man marry, the saying goes, they become one and that one is man. Now this suggests something very interesting about marriage and the importance of marriage in Griswold, right, for understanding what constitutes the private sphere and a set of boundaries. Obviously coverture doesn't last into the 20th century. It starts to devolve in the mid-19th century as states pass laws that allow married women to hold property. But prior to that time, a married woman couldn't own property, enter contracts, obtain an education without her husband's permission, retain a salary, And in some cases, she wouldn't be held criminally responsible. She could be chastised physically and the like, right? So why? Because she was fused with her husband. And if you're not an individual self-owning person, you can't yourself hold property or make contracts. So marriage is back then is not marriage now. Marriage back then is constituted by a theory of household that has a head of household that exerts a certain authority and jurisdiction into which the state may not incur without good cause, right? All right. Now, so what have I tried to say so far? I tried to show you in the Constitution that there is at least implicitly some set of values that one might cluster under the word privacy. I've tried to take you back to a theory of the self that suggests that privacy inheres in a property theory of self-ownership. And I've shown you some exceptions to the general rule. Now, what's interesting is that by the time we get to 1890, we have enough cultural change that we need to name the right to privacy. And this is the famous article by Warren and Brandeis, The Right to Privacy. I won't read all of this out loud to you. Let me just make a couple comments as you gaze at this. So as Austin said yesterday, the problem here is that Warren, who was a law professor at the time, Brandeis became a famous justice. His daughter was getting married. They had a nice house with a wall. But this was a time in which cameras were becoming ubiquitous, and he was a very well-known person, and someone we might call paparazzi came around and tried to take pictures of the wedding, took pictures of the wedding and splayed them in the newspapers, and it was infuriating to Warren and Brandeis, and they decided they needed to do something about it, and what they did was to write a very famous article saying that there is a common law right to privacy. You can see in basically in tort law. And they make an argument that life has gotten much more complicated than used to be the case. And sensibilities have gotten refined. So whereas in the past, what we meant by privacy was no trespassing on my property. Now what we mean is that property has grown to comprise every form of possession, intangible as well as tangible. And they define the right to privacy very broadly, right? The right to life has come to mean the right to enjoy life, the right to be let alone. Now, very interesting claim made by, and I'll just note, very privileged people who felt the harm of gossip and incursion into their private space. This article became the basis for a number of cases. I'll just mention one to you, Meyer versus Nebraska, a case that grew out of English-only laws in Nebraska after World War I. Prohibition of teaching German in public schools, all right? And that law was challenged by Mr. Meyer, and the court overturned it, saying the liberty protected by the Due Process Clause without doubt denotes not merely freedom from bodily restraint, but also the right of the individual to contract, to engage in any of the common occupations of life, to acquire useful knowledge, to marry, establish a home and bring up children, to worship God according to the dictates of his own conscience, and generally to enjoy those privileges long recognized at common law as essential to the orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. So again, we see a reference back to common law principles, and I think this is what Griswold means by predating the Bill of Rights. You go back to English law in order to identify certain areas of freedom and autonomy from state authority. This list is not exhaustive, and it, again, ends in a very broad premise. So privacy can be dangerous. How do we know when it ends? Yes.
But if you say that in Griswold he's talking about marriage before the Bill of Rights,
yep,
under the Blackstonian view, it was the government was all over the place as far as, I mean, it was.
If you were a woman.
If you were a woman,
well, yeah.
You know, you're part of that marriage. You can't do this. You can't do that. You can't do this.
Yeah.
So that's inconsistent with.
Yeah.
But not with the Blackstone.
Well, you know, it's like saying, what do we mean by all men are created equal, right, when we have slaves in this country, right? The word man becomes a legal fiction. It means, in that case, I would think property male citizen, something like that. So, you know, that's implicit. And again, it's the implicit knowledge that I think Griswold is trying to point to here. It, you know, what is it that was assumed at the time? What is it that you can read in between the lines? Now, we can totally disagree, and we can also say, look, Ed, that's a bad theory of constitutional interpretation. You really need to have a word in there so that we understand why the word is put there and what the founders meant. And that's a very venerable theory of textual interpretation.
Pardon? It's Black's argument.
Yes, it's Black's argument. It's Justice Scalia's argument, Rehnquist's argument. Exactly, yes.
When I first saw what Justice Douglas meant, older than time, so to speak,
yeah.
I thought of natural law. So how does that play into...
Well, I mean, Locke would argue that... owning oneself is part of the law of nature, right? That's what he said. In a state of nature, we own ourselves. We can resist any arbitrary incursion. So for him, property is natural. I mean, in the Declaration, right, it's an inalienable right. Inalienable means unsellable. I mean, it's a property term. So property theory was understood to be of natural law. It was linked very clearly in the 18th century. Yeah. Okay, so this is broad. Right to be let alone, you know, orderly pursuit of happiness by free men. You know, how do we put content into that? That's difficult. You've seen what Griswold did. I want to show you a case that came relatively soon after Griswold, Eisenstadt versus Baird. This is where I think you can see a shift in conception from an older version of privacy as related to marriage to what we might call, you know, the swinging 70s version of social identity, right? Eisenstadt versus Baird was about the distribution of sale of contraceptions not to married persons but to anyone, unmarried couples. It is true that in Griswold, the right to privacy in question inhered in the marital relationship. Now that, remember how important that was. It was sacred. It was the foundation of society, right? That's why we knew that it was sacred from government interference, because it was more important than any government. Yet the marital couple is not an independent entity with a mind and heart of its own. Well, Blackstone would disagree. But an association of two individuals. You can see feminism right there, right? Each with a separate intellectual and emotional makeup. If the right to privacy means anything, it is the right of the individual, married or single, to be free from unwarranted government intrusion into matters so fundamentally affecting a person as the decision whether to bear or beget a child. All right. So we have unhooked privacy from the tetherable, cognizable older conception of marriage. That was traditional and really anchored certain kinds of values into the 1960s. And we've located privacy in individuals themselves, not in a relation that's protected from the state, at least to some extent, but in individuals themselves. This, I take it to be a moment when the danger of privacy becomes more visible. I mean, is it that I just get to do what I want, you know, as long as I don't murder somebody in my house? Do I get to decide? Is it a kind of subjective thing? Or is it part of a relation that's sanctified socially in ways that that were very meaningful? So Eisenstadt versus Baird, I think, is the more radical gesture in some ways than Griswold, because it tethers privacy to what an individual wants to do. That was my... done some years ago playing with my PowerPoint. Now you can see then this language in Roe, this, and of course this is the most controversial right to privacy case until, anyway, maybe we get to Lawrence. This right of privacy, whether it be founded in the 14th Amendment's concept of personal liberty and restrictions upon state action, or in the 9th Amendment, is broad enough to encompass a woman's decision whether or not to terminate her pregnancy. So it's a woman's decision, and you all know Roe and its complicated understanding of what that decision is about. It's a decision made in relation to a woman's physician. It's not a woman just sitting around saying, well, this is what I decide. It's actually, there's a relationship involved that Roe imagines and posits. But it is the case that Roe says a woman's decision is protected. It's important to note that word decision because this is positing a woman as someone who can rationally choose something, right? In other words, we've gotten to a point where women are understood to be self-owning in the same way as Locke would have imagined men to be self-owning earlier on. Locke said, all men are born free, equal, and with reason. All right? In the 19th century, women were often assimilated to children. But by the late 20th century, women have become imagined as autonomous decision makers on our own. So Roe sort of forwards that idea of privacy. Interestingly, and again, Austin, it's funny, we didn't talk about what we were going to say, but Austin mentioned Catherine MacKinnon yesterday, wrote an article saying, you know, it would have been better to argue Roe versus Wade as an equality decision for women, because the argument there is that women need to control our own reproductive lives in order to be able to enter the public sphere, you know, without restraint. And privacy has historically been used to suppress women's freedoms. That's what MacKinnon argues. I think the difficulty was that the equality jurisprudence, the gender equality jurisprudence, really wasn't developed at all by 1973, but the privacy jurisprudence had been established in Griswold and in Eisenstadt. This was the stronger line of cases. It was a strategic decision made not to argue this as an equality case, but you can understand it as such, and that's an important thing. The argument would be that women gain equality by becoming more like men, that is to say, free of reproductive constraint. All right. Now, of course, the danger is if privacy is about individual choice, where do we draw the line so that we know where the right to privacy stops? And who gets to decide where we draw the line? I mean, that's another big aspect of the problem here. As we go forward, I think privacy and equality converge both in the reproductive rights cases and in the gay rights cases. Because both involve sexual identity and reproduction in ways that are indicative of social differences. And the argument, of course, from the gay rights perspective, and here I just want to be cognizant of my time, is that as you read with Justice Scalia's dissent, you know, society has a right to judge certain kinds of behavior immoral. And if a class of persons engages in that behavior, then it's justifiable to criminalize that behavior and therefore to discriminate against those who engage in that behavior as a matter of identity. So if you were, you know, as we all remember, right, in the 1970s and 80s, a gay man or a lesbian and subject to criminal law, you could justifiably be fired from any job, for sure, because you're a criminal. That's the whole point. You violate criminal law. We are allowed to discriminate against criminals, for sure. So arguing that we have an individual liberty right, we might say, privacy right or liberty interest, in consensual sexual behavior is both a privacy argument and an equality argument. Let's see. I don't know why I did that. And just to show you again, this is going to be super thumbnail and way too fast. When we talk about equal protection, I read you the language that said states may not deny equal protection of the laws to people. And the question, of course, has always been, what do we mean by equal protection? That's actually not an easy thing to figure out. One thing we mean is that the Equal Protection Clause only applies to what we call discrete and insular minorities, and we often think that or suggest that those social differences that are covered by the 14th Amendment are immutable social differences. That is to say, your racial identity, you're discriminated against because of it, you can't change it, it's arbitrary and unfair, and so therefore the discrimination violates the 14th Amendment. Similarly, in most cases, gender. Sexual orientation, of course, there was always a debate. There was a debate about whether or not it was a choice or not to engage in same-sex sexual behavior. It is the case even now that gay men and lesbians are not considered a class of people that should be covered by heightened scrutiny under the 14th Amendment Equal Protection Clause. There's another debate in equality law that has to do with how we even understand what equality is. I just taught my my law's history class. We were talking about historical injustice, and we talked about slavery, read Beloved, and then we read some affirmative action cases. And the question is, as you would know, right, how do we understand what race should mean when we talk about equality? Should we adopt the Brown versus Board of Education model that we shouldn't see race, that we should be colorblind? Or should we adopt, that's understood as formal equality, or should we adopt a more substantive model that suggests, well, if there are people who've been structurally disadvantaged, we need to do something and recognize race in order to help them? The model of equality that has won the day for the Supreme Court is formal equality. If you've just read about the latest affirmative action and higher education case, Shuette came down this last week, you'll see that the colorblind theory of equal protection has now won the day. That means, in effect, that what equality means is that we ought to treat like people alike. It's an Aristotelian idea. So if we think that women and men are fundamentally the same, we ought to treat them the same. In situations where we think women and men are different, then we can treat them differently. So you have to decide, is that group of people the same as those who are privileged or so different from that they're capable of being discriminated against justly? This was the case that predated Lawrence, Bowers versus Hardwick. Again, a challenge to criminalization of same-sex conduct based on morality alone. In that case, this is 1986, the court suggested that the decisions of individuals' relation to homosexual conduct have been subject to state intervention throughout the history of Western civilization. Condemnation of those practices is firmly rooted in Judeo-Christian moral and ethical standards, and therefore justifiably criminalized. So Bowers, which Lawrence overturned, suggested that gay men and lesbians were different enough because of a tradition of moral condemnation that they could be justly criminalized. I'm going to speed through Romer versus Evans. Oh, I don't know why it's doing that. That's so bad. By the time we get to Lawrence, we see the conflation of equality and due process. And what that means is that the Lawrence Court has not only decided something about whether morality is properly associated with law, but has decided that gay men and lesbians are and ought to be treated the same as heterosexual people, right? That formal equality model. Now, why is this important? Let me just wrap up my argument here. United States versus Windsor, the case that came down this summer, was arguably a case decided on no clear jurisprudential basis. So this was a case that overturned one section of the Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed under President Clinton. And that act basically said, if one state, let's call it Massachusetts, allows same-sex marriage, no other state needs to recognize those marriages, nor does the federal government need to recognize those. And the section that was challenged in Windsor was the section about the federal government. Justice Kennedy again wrote for the majority and said, the principal purpose and the necessary effect of this law are to demean those persons who are in a lawful same-sex marriage. DOMA is unconstitutional as a deprivation of the liberty of the person protected by the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, which contains within it the prohibition against denying to any person equal protection of the laws. Now, those of you who are lawyers know that that doesn't make any sense. That claim doesn't make sense. Because the Fifth Amendment doesn't have an equal protection clause.
Yes, it does.
Oh, Jack. Does it?
Well, it has its problem.
Well, let's talk afterwards. I think the point that I want to make is less about the jurisprudential boundaries than this, that the marriage debate has become a debate about both privacy, that is to say, marriage is at the heart of the right to privacy, as we know, and equality, that is to say, formal equality. Same-sex couples are the same as married couples. All right. How does this help us? Whoops, sorry about that. How does this help us to think about how we put boundaries on, I don't know how to fix that quickly, how we put boundaries on the right to privacy? It seems to me that there are two ways to do it. one of them is to turn back to a kind of history and tradition, as the court has done, and say, well, we'll look back at older models of these sort of implicit things that constitute privacy, one of which is marriage. And so in some respects, the same-sex marriage cases as privacy cases are relatively easy. Once you suggest that it's okay for same-sex couples to be married, then the right to privacy is squarely, you know, within that bound. And to that extent, I would argue that that's a conservative move. I mean, after all, marriage for same-sex couples is about assimilation into a culture that pre-exists. It's not about some radical, you know, sexual liberation moment. Quite the opposite. It's a claim that we're just like you, and we want to be treated just like you, and we're happy to be just like you. And that means that it's a conservative political argument at its core in relation to the right to privacy. It's not about, oh, we can do whatever we want in our bedrooms, and it's all about what I want. It's taking on a relatively traditional institution and arguing that same-sex couples fit in it very well. And that is indeed, I think, what the Windsor rhetoric suggests. That same-sex couples are equal to heterosexual couples. Interesting cases coming down the line will have to do with polygamy and whether or not the same kinds of arguments can be made. There's a late 19th century case that says it's fine to prohibit polygamy. It doesn't fall under the free exercise clause of the First Amendment. But now we have a right to privacy. And we have a right to privacy that allows it to stretch far enough to cover marriage, which is not a big stretch. What about polygamy? I think that'll be an interesting next argument about how far the right to privacy goes. I think that the idea of treating likes alike is a check on the slippery slope argument, in other words. It suggests that we do know boundaries. They're known boundaries. We've had them before. We can see them centrally in our culture. And so Justice Scalia is wrong to assimilate, you know, the sort of problem of same-sex marriage to the slippery slope. It's a rhetorical and political move. It's not necessarily an analytical move. But I think it's one that that sets some boundaries on what the right to privacy can cover. I think, actually, I'm going to stop there. We're getting pretty close to the time we said we would just generally stop, and I've talked on and on enough. Why don't I take a couple of questions on this, if you'd like, and then maybe we can do a little bit of a wrap-up. Yeah.
So I'm a license plate reader company.
Okay.
And I have rights.
Mm-hmm.
And my rights extend to be able to collect your license plate data in the public sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, can't we go back to Hobby Lobby now and say...
Sure, we can go back to Hobby Lobby.
I mean, isn't that where it's going to go?
Is that where it's going to go? I mean, you know, Hobby Lobby is a, what?
Sorry. I mean, no, I'm saying, why not just throw corporate like to like? Why not, you know, and then, you know, my argument again about does Google have the right to you sign something, and is their right the same as yours to privacy? It seems like you very quickly would get into equating corporate rights with private rights, and therefore, you know, if you can argue that corporate is like to human beings who have privacy, then...
Right. Well, how would you make that argument? That strikes me as harder than a speech argument.
At the end of the day,
I know.
Well,
right. Well, it depends on how you frame privacy. If you frame privacy as autonomy in decision making, then I think it's easier to assimilate corporations to that model. It's more like a free speech model. If you equate privacy with property rights, then I think maybe it's a little less easy to make that set of claims. And I think if there is an incoherence, there's a lot of indeterminacy around what we mean by privacy. And so I have not yet decided whether a turn back to property language is the best way to go here. But I do think it inflects arguments in different directions. So if we go with liberty and autonomy, then we can imagine the entity that has liberty and autonomy pretty expansively. But I'm not sure that property language would enable that kind of argument. Yes?
Said many times that in our political system, important decisions are decided by the court.
Yeah.
And it's also been said that the court follows election returns. Both of those are right.
Yeah.
And the biggest change in my lifetime has been the acceptance of gay marriage.
Yep.
One of the things that happened. There's no victim in gay marriage. And everybody said, well, I know Joe and John. They're okay.
Right.
So what's the problem?
Right.
But the people who come out to our clinics with the signs,
yep.
They're not worried about privacy of the mother.
Right.
They're worried about life and death of the fetus.
Right.
And once you have a victim,
right.
You've got a different situation.
Right. Well, the claim in that case, of course, is that the fetus is a legal person and has privacy rights that can repel violence. So it demands a kind of philosophical argument about whether or not that ought to be adopted as a legal claim. So I agree with you there. Although, of course, it's certainly been the case that in the gay marriage situation, advocates against gay marriage or same-sex marriage have claimed harm to marriage itself. You wouldn't call that an individual victim with privacy rights. So I take the point.
But they have a tough time proving them.
They do.
Marriage is jeopardized by,
they do. They do. Those arguments don't fly well in court because they have no empirical evidence. I think that's exactly right. No, I agree. I agree. So is it a false equivalence? Well, I'm not sure it's a false equivalence. I do think that in the abortion context, what you have is one way to frame abortion is as a competing interest toward liberty, autonomy, privacy, and freedom. If you frame a fetus as a person, then you've got a problem. I agree. The other thing I would say, just to close, about the importation of equality thinking into privacy is that it inflects one important argument that's been made that I didn't really touch on, which is the argument about whether it's okay for judges to make these calls or whether we should leave these things to legislatures. In the area of privacy, that's been a very big deal. Unelected judges are overturning democratic processes. If you think about the area of equality, though, you have a counter-majoritarian premise at stake, which is to say the 14th Amendment's Equal Protection Clause is supposed to protect against majority overriding of minority interests. So once you begin to conflate equality language into privacy, you have a little bit more space to make an argument that judges are the appropriate decision makers. Whether or not it's a good claim or not is up to your own judgment, but I think it enables a certain anti-majoritarian politics. All right, well, thank you for your attention to this jurisprudential talk. Let me just try to say one or two things by way of sum up, and then I know Marcy wants to say so long, farewell, auf Wiedersehen, adieu to you, and you. I think, we've talked about privacy in a number of different ways, and one of the things that I've tried to do is think about it in the context of what law would, this jurisprudence would call something more transcendent or intangible. There is a way in which it's easy enough to think about privacy if we think about it geographically, and I'm in my home, and then what happens when my data goes out of my home kind of screws up that as a matter of permeable boundaries. But that's a coherent claim, I think, to make constitutionally. More arguable is this claim about whether intimacy is protected by privacy, what kinds of intimacies and where. That tends to be bound up with arguments about space. So you can have sex in private, but not in a public park. Not all intimacies are private, just by virtue of being intimate. Those two things seem to be bound up. The issue I think we really brought up in this morning's conversation in particular has to do with something I alluded to before, which is, what does it mean for someone, let's take the Lockean self-owning person, to speak and then have that speech turned into a representation of self online, right? So that you don't have the kind of bounded self anymore and the ephemerality of the spoken word as a way to think about what can be contained in a private sphere. Once you actually materialize speech and personal information and send it off, it's infinitely replicable and it's always in an archive. I mean, that's the other thing. It doesn't go away. So what we're contending with, I think, is a different version of what a self is now. I mean, I think the most fundamental thing we've been talking about in this set of conversations is, what kind of self are we imagining when we imagine ourselves, in a Lockean way as opposed to in a kind of postmodern online way as an avatar? It's not just, I'm a self-owner versus I love connection, right? It's about a reconceptualization of who I am. So that when Austin jokes that he can't go around without his cell phone on, he's saying that his self is different than the self we might have imagined 20 years ago. that there is a tether outward that's very meaningful and that redefines our sense of who we are. And this is really partly what Laura was talking about, too. How do we internalize the sense that we're always being watched? And what difference does that make? That comes up in the film you saw last night. And yet, we can, we're not just acceding to this, we're embracing it, we're seduced by it. And there are great opportunities to connect with people, to create communities, to foment political movements. You know, the technology is not in itself pernicious technology, but it can enable some beautiful things, right? The question is, how do we think about and value the uses to which the technology is put? How do we think about and value this sort of reconceptualization of self as self in connection or in relation to someone else? It's not necessarily a bad thing to get rid of this idea of self-ownership at all. After all, only a few people really had it to begin with, right? More than half the population was connected in ways that were probably not great from a legal point of view in the 18th and 19th centuries. So that in itself is not a great thing. But what is it that we lose, too, when we engage in this sort of projection outward? And that's the question I ask my students when I ask them to walk in the woods. You know, what are the gains and what are the losses? How do you imagine? How do you feel? How do you feel about yourself? How do you conceive yourself? So if you leave this thinking more about that and thinking about my students as embodying a somewhat different self than I think you and I do, then I think these debates will be even more legible to you. But I want to thank you for an incredibly stimulating day and a half. I've really enjoyed your company. Thank you for your attention and your care and your commitment to the conversation. And I hope we see you all again at whatever the next fabulous Amherst Today is. Marcy.